HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dangerous Ground, My Friendship with a Serial Killer, by M. William Phelps, read by Tom Perkins. It isn't so different, the way we wander through the past. Lost, disordered, fearful, we follow what signs there remain. We read the street names, but cannot be confident where we are. All around is wreckage. Julian Barnes, Flaubert's Parrot. Prologue. She is dead. On a metal slab, a sheet covering her body, a tag hanging from her big toe. Manner and cause of death will be determined soon. Murder by strangulation. He is, contrarily, alive, standing in my kitchen. I walk in. He appears to be waiting for the ding to tell him the Howard Johnson's macaroni and cheese dinner in the plastic frozen boat he placed inside the microwave has been fully nuked. But I notice the carousel inside the oven is not making that squeaky noise it does when it is on. Also, he is not moving. His head is bowed as if he's trying to touch his chin to his chest, the folds of his neck fat exposed like rising dough. His eyes are closed. His right hand is on top of the microwave, his left by his side. The familiar-smelling richness of the melting cheese is not there, and this is an aroma that permeates the kitchen air whenever he cooks this meal. In a strange moment of reflection, I don't see my oldest brother nodded out in a methadone-induced coma while standing erect in front of the microwave, but a corpse, a dead man standing. All he cooks is mac and cheese and those baked stuffed clams full of breadcrumbs in the half shell. He lives off pills, methadone, beer, cheese, and gluten. Mark? He does not answer. Mark? Nothing. I toss my keys on the kitchen table, walk over, shake him. It is April 12, 1996. I am 29 and separated from my wife for the past 2 years. I will be officially divorced in a few months, remarried 6 months later on New Year's Eve to a woman I haven't met yet. Mark is living with me in a house the bank is about to foreclose on. We're both biding our time, waiting for the sheriff to come and tell us to leave. He has recently split with his wife, Diane, who was living in Hartford, Connecticut on Garden Street, not far from Asylum Hill. A 41-year-old woman was murdered the previous year on Huntington Street, just a mile away. Unbeknownst to any of us then, a serial killer is on the loose in the Asylum Hill section of Hartford, plucking women off the street, raping, beating, and killing them. Hartford is 12 miles from my house. Last I hear, 34-year-old Diane, her actual name is Diana, but we call her Diane, is pregnant. Mark isn't sure if it is his child, and this tears him apart. He tells me he's done with her for good this time. It's over. Yet in the 20 years they have been together, we have all heard this. After each fight, after each one has had the other arrested, after they hit and scratch and berate each other in front of their kids at retail stores, restaurants, and all sorts of other public places. "Hey, man, wake up," I say, and shake him again. Mark is 39. That's young, I know, but he looks 50, maybe older. The life he's led has taken its toll. The silent killer, hepatitis C, is coursing through his veins. "Mark, wake up, man." A snot-like length of drool hangs from his mouth. After he comes to, figures out where he is, acclimates himself to his surroundings as if he is on a boat trying to manage large swells, he takes his half-cooked mac and cheese and heads down the 5 flights of stairs to his space in the house. He mumbles something I cannot understand. I can decode what he says about 20% of the time. Later on, I will have to clean up after he spills the macaroni all over himself, on his bed, the floor, before passing out again. The used boat his food came in will be on his lap, now an ashtray, and the juxtaposition of the ashes and leftover cheese, a cigarette butt stabbed into a piece of elbow macaroni, will remind me that life is, in the end, about choices. Several hours later, daylight has given itself to night. Mark is standing in my kitchen again, staring out the window, waiting, anxious as each car drives by the house, headlight beams like a Hollywood premiere strobing across the wallpaper. He is somewhat coherent. His belly full of cheese and pasta, the methadone and pills have worn off. After he leaves, it will occur to me that as he stood in the kitchen, an image of his face reflected in the window pane as he waited for a ride, I saw myself standing in the same spot at 15 years old, waiting for my friend, older and able to buy liquor, to come and pick me up so we could go get loaded. "Shopping," he says after I ask. "A friend is on her way." "Don't come back all drunk and high," I warn. "I won't let you in." He looks at me, doesn't respond, lifts his cigarette up to his mouth, his fingers stained Listerine yellow from the nicotine, Hep C, or both. He inhales deeply, blows what's left of the smoke at the window pane, fogging it up. His disability check and food stamps allow him to feed himself, but he also trades some of the food, or sells the food stamps at a 50% loss, for booze and Newports. As a kid, I liked the Newport package with the upside-down Nike symbol. However, stealing and smoking his cigarettes came with a tic-tac-like cold burn in my lungs, so I wound up switching to Marlboro. He'll be broke in 2 days, eating my food, calling and begging our mother for money. She'll give it to him. He'll buy pills with that money because his methadone is regulated. A taxi, paid for by the state of Connecticut, picks him up every morning, brings him into Hartford, and returns him home. At the clinic, they give him his dose of Kool-Aid. Sometimes he stores up several doses so he can go on a bender. It is a cycle, one we've been on most of our lives. No one tries to stop Mark anymore because we can't. It is while he is shopping that I get the call. A fucking call that will not be a shock to most in my family, but will change Mark forever, send him on a new course, and initiate a suicide that will take him 8 years to complete. Several days before the call, Mark came upstairs. I asked him to sit down. "I need to tell you what I have told you 12 times since you moved in." As calm as I could, I explained, "I know that while I'm at work, Diane is coming over." Knowing Diane all my life, I was confident she was rummaging through my house looking for things to pawn or information about me to hold over my head. "I don't want her in the house. She cannot be in this house." He said something about being the older brother, more experienced in life, and how I should respect that. "And you never have. I love her. We're getting back together." It's hard, however, for me to look up to a man with burn marks all over his chest from nodding out while smoking, all his shirts with tiny burn holes on them, the bed he sleeps in and his sheets the same. Mark is a man who spends 15 hours a day basically unconscious, takes opiates and methadone together while drinking cans of Busch beer, and has not been a father to his 3 kids since they wore diapers. I love him, but I am perpetually furious with this man. He gave up on life long ago for reasons I do not understand. For a response, I go to my emotional childhood bank and withdraw something our father would have said in this same situation. "But this is my house, Mark. My rules if you want to live here. And I don't want Diane over here." He is nodding as we speak, in and out. His eyes languid, tired, Marty Feldman bulged. His skin is slithery, the shiny texture of a salamander with a subtle hue of yellow, like a healing bruise, same as the whites of his eyes, a strange, dull urine color. He is sickly-looking, gaunt and emaciated. At times he resembles a Holocaust victim staring back at me through an invisible fence between us. He has an anesthetic smell to him, same as a patient in a hospital. You walk down into the area of my split-level ranch-style home where he lives on the bottom floor, and it reeks of a rich, cigarette butts stuffed inside a can of beer, stale tar odor that is part of the house forever. He sleeps on one of those pull-out couch beds with the springs that stick into your back. There are empty see-through orange pill containers all over the place. Beer cans, dishes, drinking glasses, old newspapers, Greyhound racing programs, pencils, pens, 2-liter Coke bottles, fruit flies hovering, cigarette butts, silver-gray ashes. So many ashes. The remnants of his smoking covers everything like dust. The carpet around where he sleeps is dirty and worn. There are small burn holes all over the area surrounding his Archie Bunker chair, and they look similar to tiny craters on the surface of the moon. I have installed 4 smoke detectors in an area the size of a 1-car garage. In this moment of our lives, if there is one thing about my brother I can count on, it's that his addiction runs his life and has him on a strict schedule. When I was growing up, and he lived with Diane and the kids, everything about their lives was unpredictable. You never knew what they were going to do next. At this point, my brother is, if nothing else, confined to some sort of controlled insanity only he comprehends, and visible in his physical destruction. Abnormally and enormously bloated Hep C stomach, frail arms, old man's saggy skin legs, the wires of his tendons exposed, white fingernails, dry lips cracking and sometimes bleeding, his greasy black hair from not showering regularly. "Did she kill that man?" I ask after we agree that Diane cannot come into the house ever again. He stares at me, looks down at the kitchen table. He knows what I'm talking about. A few years before this conversation, a man was found stabbed to death inside Diane's vehicle. She had driven him to Hartford on the night he was murdered. It is unclear what happened. He was a man she met at a bar while she was living with my brother at a nearby scuzzy motel. Diane was not in the car at the time the man was murdered, she claimed. "Not talking about that with you," he says. "She would never kill anyone." Mark leaves to go shopping. I put on some music and relax. The phone rings. That fucking call. It's our other brother, Thomas, whom we call Tommy. He and I are closest in age and get along same as good friends. Tommy lives a few miles away. 2 of Mark and Diane's kids live with him. First, it was me and my soon-to-be ex-wife. Now Tommy is their official foster parent. Their other child, the oldest, lives with an aunt in a neighboring town. "She's dead," Tommy says. "Strangled to death." It doesn't register. "What do you mean? Who's dead?" "Just heard. Ma called me. She heard, too. Someone murdered Diane. Where's Mark?" "Shopping." "Shit, dude. Are you sure?" "Yeah, we're sure." "What are you going to tell the kids?" "I don't know." I couldn't have known at the time, but 15 years after that phone call, my relationship with a man who had strangled 8 women to death would set me on the road to resolving some of the issues I faced when my familial and personal worlds unraveled. That early evening, my brother Tommy called and told me Diane had been murdered was the Phelps family's introduction to the ripple effect murder would have on all of us forever. Like so many other families I'd become involved with through my work, as murder became part of our lives that night, we would never be the same people. "You mentioned a little bit about your loss," my serial killer tells me one day. "A death wakes up the family. Maybe some good can come of it. maybe a scared straight course for the Phelps clan. In September 2011, I wrote to this man, one of the nation's most notable nicknamed serial killers. My goal at the time was to convince him to act as a consultant, an anonymous profiling source on my Investigation Discovery television series Dark Minds. Concerned about glorifying his crimes or re-victimizing the 8 females he murdered, his identity remained secret throughout his tenure on the series and after. He was known to audiences only as Raven, a disguised voice on the telephone explaining what was going through the mind of the serial killers I hunted and profiled each week. But as the series aired and our relationship progressed, something happened. We became friends. "I can help you look at your sister-in-law's murder," he continues, "and offer my understanding. Hard to believe a convicted serial killer has something valuable to say, but what I offer is insight into the mind of how this killer thinks. I see through cases because I have witnessed this kind of evil firsthand, lived with evil 24 hours a day." I had no idea how to respond to this. He encouraged me to listen and learn. As we began, the true emotional, physical, and spiritual impact this relationship would have on my life, or how his insight would affect my everyday thinking on top of the relationship with my family, was hidden, a series of blows I could have never imagined. "Sorry for your loss," he says. "Don't make excuses for her. She was doing what she wanted to do." We play at a cost. Then someone dies and we look at ourselves for answers. My 5-year friendship with a serial killer, same as my relationship with Mark and Diane, would not only change who I was, but break me. There had been too many times to count when all of us, my brothers Tommy and Frankie, mother and father and stepfather, wives and cousins and uncles and aunts and friends had said, "I wish Diane would go away for good." For me personally, I'd considered a number of times how I wished to hell someone would take Diane out. She'd caused our family so much pain, so much grief. It was drama every day with her. We all wanted her out of our lives. And now, suddenly, just like that, she was. "I'll tell Mark when he gets back," I explained to my brother Tommy. The details are hard to come by in a day and age without internet and cell phones, but with a few calls I pieced together that someone put a pillowcase over Diane's head and strangled her with a telephone cord. At least, that's what has been reported. She was found inside the Hartford apartment she'd been living in since her split with my brother. She was, it had been confirmed, 5 months pregnant. After hanging up and sitting at my kitchen table, I go back to the previous night. Mark had been out all night. A recluse, saddled by his addictions, he never went anywhere other than to the methadone clinic, liquor store, and market to get his mac and cheese and clams, coke, cigarettes, and 30 racks of Busch beer. But last night, he was gone. If the cops come around my house asking questions, there's no way I can vouch for his whereabouts. I walk downstairs into Mark's section of the house, stare at his belongings, not sure what I'm looking for. This house, which I have lived in since I was 13 years old in 1980, raised 2 kids of my own in, is nothing more than a body without a soul. It's empty, besides Mark and me. Vacant and soiled. All of this mess down here, the remnants of his life, is beyond sad. A few trinkets, a few photos of Mark's kids and Diane, his TV guide, his New York Giants pennant and hat, his remote control and television, a few hefty bags of clothes, is all he has left. The anger I feel toward him comes from the fact that I'm his caretaker. He is the older brother, the one I should be going to for advice and security, but I am all of that and more. Before he returns home from shopping, I have to decide how I will tell my brother that his wife, a woman he has known since she was a teenager, is dead, as it occurs to me that he might know already. I have this sick feeling. I don't know what it is, but it's real, and it is gnawing at me. Part 1. Friends. 1. Meeting my friend, the psychopath. Well, evil to some is always good to others. Jane Austen, Emma. The check-in entrance for a prison visit at Oregon State Penitentiary looks, ironically, similar to the facade of a downtown Chicago 1930s-era gangster hotel. There's a canopy overhanging two sets of concrete stairs, each fanning out in opposite directions like praying mantis legs. The stucco wall leading to the door is grimy, the color and texture of cantaloupe skin, chipped and covered with mold in places. Walking in, you are overwhelmed by the potent smell of sweat, stale perfumes, and mildew. Once inside, I couldn't help but notice a young pregnant woman with lots of tattoos, a disappointed look on her face, sitting alone, staring at the floor. "Denied access," the guard behind the counter explained after looking up and asking for my photo ID. "She's been here for hours." "Name? License? Who are you here to see?" I tell him. He taps away at his computer, turns to me. "You cannot wear those clothes. You'll have to change, or you cannot go in." My blue jeans and button-up shirt were not part of the dress code. Any clothing similar to what an inmate wears is off-limits. The day had begun on a high note, with baby blue skies, soft white cumulus clouds, warm air radiating from the tar in hazy waves. It was Friday afternoon, September 14, 2012. The coast-to-coast journey from Connecticut was exhausting, plagued by airport idiots causing unnecessary delays. I didn't know it then, but after my prison visit, I'd be robbed in downtown Salem of my passport, iPad, phone, rosary beads, and other personal possessions by a meth addict bearing an uncanny resemblance to one of the Backstreet Boys. By the end of the night, I'd be staring at the ceiling of my Portland hotel room, a warning a dear friend gave me before I left, keeping me tossing and turning. If the devil knocks at your door and you invite him in, you had damn well better be prepared to dine with him. After sorting out my garment issue, a guard walked me and several others through a metal detector, then down an incline similar to a handicap ramp, where we stopped at a set of barred doors. A guard sat behind tinted glass in a kiosk to our left. The smell here was heavy, stuffy, and wretched. Think of a laundry hamper full of dirty clothes. Ahead of us were a series of old-fashioned iron prison doors that made loud, echoing steel-against-steel latching noises as they snapped and locked shut. I'd been in over a dozen prisons. It is the supermaxes, like OSP, that have a sticky coat of scum on everything. As I entered the visitor's area, it was loud and noticeably humid. Everyone spoke over one another. Women fanned themselves with their hands and newspapers like they do in the South on Sundays in church. I scanned the room and saw him waiting for me on the opposite side. He was a human being who was hard to miss, clocking in at about 300 pounds, give or take. He stood 6'6" and sported gray-black hair, military buzz cut, hazy blue eyes, the beginning of cataracts. He wore a pair of off-trend 1970s-era large-framed glasses, which reminded me of Peter Fonda's character in the film Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. This massive, handsome man, representing the polar opposite of everything I believe and promote, smiled and waved me over. We sat across from each other on stiff wooden chairs. He looked at me with the smooth, glassy shimmer only a psychopath can invoke. The depth of evil was inherent and natural. same as the slight nervous smile he maintained throughout our conversation. All of it reminded me that a serial killer is a craftsman, a professional, in so many ways. This was a man who had killed for purpose and reason. Every act and every thought and every word and every lie was carefully structured around an agenda, planned and thought out. Contrary to the public perception that most serial murderers are white males in their 30s living in their parents' basement, serial killers actually fit no particular stereotype. All are different. This man I sat in front of shredded the common myth that the serial killer psychopath is a solitary figure, a loner, a person without social skills who is afraid to allow anyone inside his head or get close to him. His hands are the size of potholders. He had them cupped over his knees, feet away from my throat. I stared and thought, those are the same hands he killed 8 human beings with, all females, all strangled to death, one beaten bloody and unrecognizable, another allegedly secured with rope and dragged underneath his truck for 12 miles, according to him, until all identifying markers, teeth and fingerprints, and even her chest cavity were gone. The person in front of me was a monster. He and I both understood this. I made no secret about my feelings. I despise him. I view him and those like him as scum that cannot be rehabilitated and will reoffend at any given chance. This man killed females for sport and enjoyed it. And these opening moments of our first visit became an existential, enlightening realization, putting the reason why I'd made the trip to begin with into perspective. "Could you kill me?" I asked him after we exchanged pleasantries. "If I had to," he said, pausing and laughing before pushing his glasses up the bridge of his nose. "I need to be clear with you about something. Despite what people say, I never raped any of them. I never needed to." The tone of his voice, something I'd come to realize as a way for him to express his deepest feelings, sounded as though he'd done his victims a favor by not raping them. He was a fair-minded killer for not sexually assaulting women. It's a skewed piece of logic, I knew, something psychopaths rely on to make themselves feel better about what they've done. Justification. Every single report led me to believe that he was motivated by sex and had raped many of his victims, yet he sat staring back at me, telling me, "No, never. That is not who I am." The reason I'd asked about murdering me was because we'd known each other by then over a year. I felt uncharacteristically comfortable sitting in front of this man. We'd spoken by phone over 100 times so far. I'd received no fewer than 100 letters, amounting to over 2,000 pages of text in that time. He'd become quite fond of me. He was on the fringes of trusting me. I was his last hope, he'd often say, for telling a part of his story the way he'd wanted it told. He'd been down 16 years and change, sentenced on November 2, 1995, to 2 life terms. His earliest parole date on paper was scheduled for March 1, 2063. He was 57 years old the first time we met in person. This serial murderer, Keith Happy Face Jesperson, will never feel the sunshine on his back again as a free man. As he should, Jesperson will die alone, a convicted, incarcerated murderer in one of the oldest, dirtiest, roughest prisons on the West Coast. "If you ever got out, would you kill again?" I asked, knowing that 60% of psychopaths released from prison go on to reoffend. Those are not good numbers. "I'd tell you no, because that is what you want to hear," he said. "And I would never want to come back to this place, but the truth is, I don't really know." I made note of his comment, "I don't really know." I sensed a fleeting jolt of honesty in his response. Prison for Happy Face was easy as long as he did the time and did not allow the time to do him. On a day-to-day basis, infamous serial killers in prison are either revered or have targets on their...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?